This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Murder Beyond the Grave True Crime Thrillers, written by James Patterson, read by Christopher Ryan Grant. Please continue listening to enjoy an excerpt from James Patterson and Marshall Karp's Red Alert, an NYPD Red mystery at the end of this story. Dear listener, above all else, I'm a storyteller. I craft stories for insatiable listeners. And though my books may seem over the top to some, I find that I am most often inspired by real life. After all, truth is stranger than fiction. The crimes in this book are 100% real. Certain elements of these stories, some scenes and dialogue, locations, names, and characters have been fictionalized. But these stories are about real people committing real crimes with real, horrifying consequences. And as terrifying and visceral as it is to hear about these crimes gone wrong, there's something to remember. The bad guy always gets caught. If you can't get enough of these true crimes, please watch the pulse-racing new television series on Investigation Discovery, Murder is Forever, where you'll see these shocking crimes come to life. I hope you're as haunted by these accounts as I am. They'll remind you that though humans have the capacity for incredible kindness, we also have the capacity for unspeakable violence and depravity. James Patterson. Murder Beyond the Grave. Chapter 1. The man gasps for air and claws at the plywood siding of his prison. He's inside a coffin that is 6 feet long and 3 feet wide. Rivulets of sweat pour from his brow. His shirt is soaked, his heart is thumping like he's just run up a flight of stairs. His skull is throbbing with a nauseating headache. He has been buried alive, at gunpoint. A stranger, disguised with a ski mask and motorcycle helmet, had kidnapped him, had clipped handcuffs around his wrists, and later, when he forced him into the box, he cut the chain between the cuffs but left the circles of metal clasped tightly to his wrists. The kidnapper left three items in the coffin: a gallon jug of cloudy water, a pile of candy bars, and a car battery attached to a caged light bulb. He has gulped half the water already, but hasn't touched the candy bars. He isn't sure how long he's been in here. The light bulb is starting to dim. He looks up at a small piece of PVC pipe sticking through the plywood and puts his mouth over the tube, trying to draw big gulps of fresh air. But though he's in good shape, his lungs strain. No matter how much air he pulls in, his chest is still heaving, still gasping for more. He knows what's happening. He's running out of oxygen. The pipe isn't doing enough to circulate fresh air into the chamber. He pushes up against the plywood and pounds on the wood with his fists. "Help!" he screams. But his vocal cords are raw from yelling so much, and he can barely catch his breath as it is. He tries to calm his panicked breathing, taking long, slow breaths. His head is pounding. "Keep it together," he tells himself. "Calm down." He remembered what the masked man said when he put him in here, that this is all about money. "Everything's going to be fine. I've worked out all the details. You're not going to die." But he's beginning to think his kidnapper is never coming back. The air smells of sour sweat, plywood, and caulk. And hidden behind those odors, barely noticeable, is the smell of freshly dug soil. The smell of his grave. He presses his trembling hands against the plywood again. This time, when he pushes upward, straining with all his strength, he feels some give in the earth. He feels a moment of hope. But when he releases the pressure, the board sags inward, like a mine shaft nearing its inevitable collapse. The light flickers. He takes deep breaths, long inhalations, slow exhalations. He tries to calm his nerves. He closes his eyes, and as he waits for the light to die and the darkness to envelop him, he thinks of the faces of his children and the woman he loves. He hopes they know how much he loves them. Chapter 2. January 1987, 8 months earlier. Danny Edwards walks down a sidewalk in Chicago, his head down, his fists buried in his coat. Flakes of snow drift in the air. Danny's breath comes out in bursts of visible vapor. Cars drive by, slicing through gray slush. Danny is 30 years old, well-dressed, and handsome. Under ordinary circumstances, he would seem like a friendly guy, but today, he has a determined look on his face. He's anxious. He pushes through the door into a steakhouse and is greeted by a rush of warm air, a cloud of cigarette smoke, and a barrel-chested host who lights up when he sees him.
"Yo, Danny," the man says, his Chicago accent thick. "Long time no see, eh?"
When the man opens his arms to give Danny a hug, Danny awkwardly thrusts a hand out for a shake instead.
"How've you been?"
Danny says, feigning a smile.
"Oh, you know,"
says his longtime associate, who, unfazed by the rebuffed embrace, claps Danny on the shoulder.
"Same old, same old."
Danny opens his mouth for more small talk, but the host cuts him off with a nod toward the kitchen.
"He's waiting for you in the back. Told me to send you in straight away."
Danny makes his way toward the rear of the restaurant, walking through tendrils of cigarette smoke. The room is full of low-hanging lamps and checkerboard tablecloths. He enters a red brick hallway and walks past the kitchen, where a white-clad cook shouts over a flaming grill, and then past the dish room, where a kid with pimples on his face and a cigarette between his lips is blasting dirty plates with a high-powered spray nozzle. In the very back of the restaurant is an oak door standing ajar, and Danny knocks gently and pokes his head inside.
"Hey, Mitch," Danny says, trying to sound nonchalant.
"Sit down,"
Mitch says to Danny without any of the good cheer the host displayed when Danny entered the restaurant. Danny sits in a leather chair across from Mitch, who is leaning over a white platter. There are no vegetables on the plate, no sides whatsoever. Just a 16-ounce porterhouse, barely seared on the outside, and as bloody as a bullet wound on the inside. Mitch, an intimidating 60-something man with silver-streaked hair and cold, dark eyes, saws into the meat and pops a dripping bite into his mouth.
"How's it going?"
Danny says.
"Cut the crap," Mitch says,
his voice like a garbage disposal filled with broken glass.
"Where's my money?"
Danny's facade breaks. He nervously glances around the room.
"Here's the thing, Mitch,"
he says, and then hesitates to continue. Mitch stares at him. He holds his fork in one hand and a steak knife in the other, but his meal is forgotten. His attention is focused on Danny. Danny takes a deep breath and then rips the band-aid off.
"The cops nabbed my cocaine,"
Danny says.
"The whole supply."
Mitch's expression is unreadable.
"I'm lucky they didn't get me,"
Danny says. Mitch continues to stare, saying nothing. Danny fidgets in his chair.
"Listen," Danny says. "I've got it all worked out. My buyers are still interested. They're hungry for product. I just need another kilo. I'll give all the profits to you. It will cover what I owe you and the new bag. You know I'm good for it."
Mitch returns to his steak without speaking. Danny waits. He can't sit still. He pulls at the collar of his shirt and wipes a bead of sweat from his brow. Mitch takes his time, cutting off another bloody hunk of steak.
"So you're going to pay me double?"
Mitch says, without looking at Danny.
"Of course."
"And a penalty fee."
Danny hesitates.
"If that's what it takes, I want to make things right."
"What's up with you?"
Mitch says, raising his eyes and fixing them on Danny.
"You seem a little bit off.
Why are you sweating so much?"
Chapter 3. Outside, in a nondescript panel van, two police officers listen with headphones.
"Damn it," says the first officer. "He's been made."
"Wait," says the other. "This guy Danny's a slick operator. Let's see what he does."
High-tech equipment lines one side of the van's interior, and the first officer adjusts a knob to try to hear the conversation better.
"I seem a bit off,"
Danny asks.
Yeah, Mitch says, his gravelly voice particularly jumbled in the earphones. Jumpy.
Jumpy?
Yeah, Mitch says, getting frustrated now. You gonna repeat everything I say?
Sorry, Danny says.
What I'm wondering is if the cops nabbed the cocaine you were selling, how is it that they didn't nab you?
The two cops look at each other.
Get ready to call in the team, the first one says. I don't want a dead informant on our hands.
The detectives spent weeks putting this operation together. After they busted Danny Edwards, they convinced him that they wouldn't charge him if he wore a wire, and helped them bring down his supplier. Danny Edwards is a little fish. They want the big kahuna. The plan is simple. Once Mitch shows Danny the drugs, Danny is supposed to say a code phrase. Then, the police will come rushing in. The only other reason they would come rushing in would be if Danny seemed to be in danger. Danny's a low-level hoodlum, but they don't want his blood on their hands.
I'm making the call,
the first officer says, picking up a walkie-talkie.
Wait,
the second says. And they both go quiet as they listen.
What, how is it that they didn't nab me?
Danny whispers.
I swear to God, you better stop repeating everything I say.
Okay, okay, Danny says.
Here's what happened.
Danny explains how he's been keeping his supply of drugs at a construction site down the road from where he does most of his deals, not in his own home. The house is a skeleton of 2x4s and plywood flooring. Just now, the roof is getting shingled and the walls are being covered in drywall. But the central air ducts are installed and it's a convenient place to keep a brick of coke hidden and dry.
That part of the house has already been inspected. You see, no one looks in there.
Why don't you just keep your coke at your own house like a normal drug dealer?
Mitch says.
Are you kidding?
Danny says.
My girlfriend would have a fit. I'd be sleeping on the street if she found out there were any drugs in the house.
Danny goes on to explain that he was selling to a couple of guys he hadn't seen before. They were asking for more than he had on him. He should have known better, he admits, but he told them to wait and he'd be back in 30 minutes. He walked to the construction site without realizing he was being followed. Once he'd reached into the vent and pulled out the brick, two other guys came running from the corner of the house waving guns and badges. Danny took off on foot and lost them when he hid in the rafters of another half-finished house at the construction site.
I saw them grab the coke, Danny says, and then I snuck off.
And these cops don't know who you are, Mitch asks.
No way, man. That's why I walked to the construction site. They don't have my plate number. They don't know the car I drive. They saw my face, but I never ended up selling them anything. Even if they found out who I was, they couldn't do anything. They've got nothing.
The two police officers listen as the conversation in their headphones goes quiet for a moment.
You were right,
says the first officer.
Told you he was a slick operator.
That was such a convincing story, he almost fooled me,
says the first cop.
If I give you more, they hear Mitch say, are you going to be careful?
Thank you so much, Danny says. I'm so happy I could kiss a pig.
Did you hear that? Says the first police officer.
The other officer nods and barks into his walkie-talkie.
Move! 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 The drug deal is going down!
Chapter 4.
Don't go kissing any pigs just yet, Mitch growls at Danny. You're still in hot water.
Danny dabs more sweat from his forehead.
This is your last chance.
Mitch points his knife toward Danny.
You know what happens if you mess this up.
A drop of red juice drips off the blade of the knife. Danny opens his mouth to answer, but then they hear a commotion going on outside the office door. There's yelling, then the sound of pans clattering and glass breaking. Then comes an ear-splitting crash, as if someone dropped a whole tray of dinner plates outside the office door.
What in the holy hell is going on out there?
Mitch snarls. Mitch stands to his feet just as the door bursts open, crashing against the wall with a bang. In seconds, the office is full of police officers pointing shotguns and pistols at Mitch and Danny. "Hands up!" a cop yells. Danny obliges. Mitch ignores the request.
"What's going on here?" he barks. "What do you think you're doing?"
"You two are under arrest,"
one cop says, leveling a pistol at Mitch's forehead. Another cop grabs Mitch and shoves him against the desk. He kicks Mitch's legs into a wide stance and begins patting him down. Another officer shoves Danny against the wall and begins patting him down as well.
"Where are the drugs?"
one of the officers asks Mitch.
"What drugs?" Mitch says. "This is a family restaurant. It's a law-abiding business."
The cop gets close to Mitch's ear and says, "You're the biggest drug dealer in the city. You know it. We know it. Everybody knows it. And now, you're finally going down for it.
Where's your evidence?"
The cops glance around the room as if they're expecting to see a brick of coke sitting out in the open. There isn't anything but Mitch's half-eaten steak.
"Don't worry,"
the cop says, pulling Mitch's hands behind his back and cuffing them.
"We'll find the evidence, even if we have to tear this place apart."
A cop yanks one of Danny's arms behind his back, fastens a cuff around it, and then pulls his other arm back and locks them together.
"Ouch," Danny mumbles.
"What's wrong?"
a cop says.
"Don't like being locked up?"
"Get used to it. We're gonna lock you up until you're old enough to collect Social Security."
The police begin searching the office, flinging open drawers on the desk and turning over furniture. Danny watches them search, then raises his eyes to look at Mitch. Mitch is glaring at him, his eyes focused and murderous. A cold chill slithers up Danny's spine. Mitch doesn't say a word, but his expression tells Danny everything he needs to know. Mitch's expression says, "I know it was you." Chapter 5. Danny sits in the rear of an unmarked police car as it rolls past the welcome sign for the city of Kankakee, Illinois. In the front seat sits the same officers who were in the panel van earlier, his handlers for the undercover operation. They are detectives with KAMEG, the Kankakee Area Metropolitan Drug Enforcement Group. Danny has forgotten their names. Both were friendly to him before, but now things are different. Ever since the bust went awry, they've been alternating between cold indifference and fiery antagonism.
"You know you could have taken these damn handcuffs off me,"
Danny says, shifting his body to find a comfortable way to sit in the seat while his hands are still locked behind his back. The officer in the passenger seat, a 40-something man with blonde hair, sideburns, and a mustache, shifts around to look at Danny. His eyes glare at Danny with nearly the same rage that had been burning in Mitch's eyes.
"You're lucky we're not throwing your ass in jail,"
the officer says.
"Hey,"
Danny says, shrugging his shoulders.
"I did my part." "You were supposed to say the code phrase after you saw the coke, not before."
"He was about to pull it out," Danny says. "I was sure of it."
"It's our fault,"
says the driver, a man about Danny's age with a buzz cut that made him look as if he just got out of the Marines.
"We assumed this high school dropout knew the difference between before and after."
"My 3-year-old knows the difference between before and after," says the officer with the mustache.
"Yeah, but your son's human."
The driver looks in the rearview mirror and fixes his eyes on Danny.
"Not a rat."
"Very funny," Danny says. "You weren't calling me a rat when I agreed to help you."
"That was back when we thought you were actually going to help us," the cop says. "Not screw us over."
"If it was up to me,"
the mustached officer says,
"I'd put your lying ass in jail. You reneged on your agreement as far as I'm concerned."
"Well, it's not up to you,"
Danny says, unable to hide his smile. The state's attorney says, "I fulfilled the terms of my deal." The cop in the passenger seat looks over at the driver.
"I told you he was a slick operator."
The driver says nothing, and quiet overtakes the car. Danny looks out the window. The car crosses a bridge over the Kankakee River. Its water is gray in the January light, and the trees lining the banks are leafless and lean. Soon, they're driving through downtown Kankakee, a short strip of old brick storefronts. With a population of about 25,000 people, Kankakee is a nice little town. Quaint, quiet, and close enough to Chicago that residents can get their big city fix whenever they need to. Danny watches the storefronts roll by, remembering growing up here. He'd ridden his bike into town on summer afternoons. He'd gone swimming in the river. He'd snuck into train cars at the old depot and smoked marijuana with his friends. His parents were well off, and he'd never been left wanting. As an adult, he'd done well for himself, just not by obeying the law. Up until recently, he'd been making $4,000 a week selling cocaine. He owned a riverfront house in an upscale neighborhood, and he'd also been making enough to lease a split-level townhouse for his girlfriend, Nancy. He paid for her place because he didn't want her and her 8-year-old son, Benji, to be close to his drug-dealing operations. Life had been great. He'd been planning to buy a boat. But then, KAMEG agents raided his Aroma Park home, seizing $10,000 in cash and 200 grams of cocaine, with a street value of $20,000. The story of the narrow escape that he told Mitch was a complete fabrication. The truth is, he'd been busted red-handed. A month ago, he'd had the world at his feet. Now, he's sleeping in Nancy's townhouse, trying to figure out how to make the monthly payment. All the money he had in the world is gone. Life as he once knew it is now over.
"Why are you looking so gloomy?"
the officer in the passenger seat says to him.
"You just lucked into a get-out-of-jail-free card."
"It doesn't feel that way," Danny says. "What am I supposed to do now?" As the police car rolls up in front of Nancy's townhouse, the two officers look at each other, incredulous. The driver turns around and glares at Danny.
"Why don't you try getting a job, like everybody else?"
Chapter 6, August, 1987. Danny swings his hammer and drives a framing nail into a 2x4. He stands inside the skeleton of a house under construction, sweating in the summer humidity. He reaches into his tool belt, pulls out another nail, and lines it up. He takes a swing and misses the nail, hitting his thumb instead.
"Damn it!"
he shouts, throwing his hammer down onto the plywood floor. He shakes his hand, trying to wring out the pain. He checks his watch. It's not quite quitting time, but close enough. He collects his hammer and heads over to the foreman, who hands him a check. Danny stares in disbelief at the numbers on the pay stub.
"Uncle Sam sure takes a bite, don't he?" the foreman says.
"And people say I'm a crook," Danny thinks.
He almost opens his mouth to ask for more hours. He sure could use the money. But he hates the work. There's got to be an easier way to make money. He climbs into his van and heads home. At a stoplight, he examines the palms of his hands. The soft flesh is full of blisters. He keeps waiting for calluses to form and for his skin to toughen up, but it hasn't happened yet. "I'm not cut out for this type of work," he thinks. The only problem is that the one type of work he is cut out for is illegal. He's been walking the straight and narrow since January because he knows that another bust will put him in prison for who knows how long. There will be no leniency this time. No deal. No get-out-of-jail-free card. He pulls up in front of the townhouse, which is in need of a new paint job. Inside, he finds Nancy, crouched in the kitchen behind the dishwasher, which she slid out from the counter. A slick of soapy water covers the linoleum floor. Her son, Benji, oblivious to the difficulties of the world, is playing in the puddle. Nancy has a roll of duct tape and is wrapping it around a pipe.
"What the hell are you doing?" Danny says. "The damn thing's leaking again," Nancy says without looking up.
Nancy Risch is a knockout. 25 years old, petite, platinum blonde. When she dresses up for a night on the town, she looks like a Barbie doll. But right now, her hair is damp and hanging in her eyes. Her sweatpants are soaked with soapy water, and she has grease on her hands and forearms, like she's an auto shop mechanic instead of a stay-at-home mom.
"That should do it,"
she says, and stands up. She presses the button to start the dishwasher again. The motor begins to hum, and they watch for more water leaking out. It appears she fixed whatever was wrong. She grabs a mop and starts to clean up the floor. Danny knows he should help, but he's dog-tired after working all day, so he just watches her. When she's finished mopping, she leans against the handle and says,
"You know, I've been thinking, it's time I go back to work."
"No," Danny says without considering it.
"Honey," she says, "we need the money."
Benji is walking around the kitchen searching for puddles. There's no more water for him to splash in, but his shoes are wet and he keeps leaving dirty footprints on the linoleum. "I'll think of something," Danny says. "I'll get back on my feet. I promise." Nancy approaches him, and even in her soaked sweatpants and dirty tank top, she is still beautiful. She puts her arms around his neck and pulls his face down for a long kiss.
"I'm so proud of you for not dealing anymore," she says. "Times are tough right now, but they're gonna get better. You're doing the right thing. Let me help you."
Danny shakes his head. When he first met her, Nancy had been working two jobs and somehow taking care of Benji and what little free time she had. She'd gotten pregnant and married as a teenager, and ever since she divorced her husband, she'd worked odd jobs. Waitressing, selling makeup, cleaning houses. He'd been able to take her from that life. He'd be damned if he was the reason she had to go back to it. He wraps his arms around her and embraces her. She closes her eyes and rests her head on his chest. They hear Benji splashing in a puddle.
"I thought I got it all,"
Nancy says, opening her eyes. The dishwasher is leaking again. Chapter 7. Danny drives down the tree-lined streets of the Tony neighborhood where his parents live. His van's window is down because even though it's only mid-morning, the day is hot and humid. Danny parks his van in front of his parents' home, a big two-story house with a large front porch with columns flanking the front door. He cuts through the grass and takes the porch steps two at a time. He raps on the door and waits. He can hear a lawnmower down the street and somewhere kids are playing and laughing. He feels a pang of nostalgia for his own childhood, a time when life was simpler and easier. When his father comes to the door, Danny expects to be invited in, but instead, George Edwards steps out onto the porch and closes the door behind him. His hair is grayer than the last time Danny saw him. His eyes look weary. "What do you want, Danny?" Danny frowns.
"How about a hello, son? It's good to see you."
His father crosses his arms and leans against the porch railing. He repeats his question. "What do you want, Danny?" Danny huffs.
"It's nice to see you too,"
he says sarcastically. When his dad doesn't say anything else, Danny says,
"Look, Dad, I need a loan. I just need some help getting back on my feet. I promise I will pay you back."
"No."
"I've cleaned up my act," Danny says. "I'm staying out of trouble, making important changes in my life. Nancy and I need a little help, that's all."
"No," his father says. "I'm done helping you." Danny opens his mouth to object, but his father doesn't give him the chance.
"I offered you a place in the family business," his father says, "but you didn't want to be an electrician. Then I offered you a job at the grocery store I own. You didn't want anything to do with that either."
Danny doesn't have a defense. He's always preferred easy money to hard work and started selling marijuana in high school.
"May I also remind you," his father says, "that when you dropped out of high school and married Peggy, I gave you a house. A house, Danny."
Danny lowers his head. After he divorced his wife so he could be with Nancy, he and his ex-wife had sold the house, and he'd used his share to get in the door of the cocaine business.
"Look," Danny says, trying to sound sincere, "I understand why you don't want to help me. I've screwed up in the past, but I'm really trying to do the right thing here."
His father takes a deep breath, and Danny feels relieved that he's finally gotten to the old man.
"I hope what you say is true, Danny. I hope you've cleaned up your act. But I won't help you anymore."
Danny's hope evaporates.
You've hurt me too many times in the past, his dad says. With that, his father opens the front door and walks back inside. Danny can hear the click as his father throws the deadbolt.
Well, the hell with you, Danny mutters. You old son of a bitch.
He climbs back into his van and begins driving through Kankakee. He isn't ready to go home and face Nancy. He knows the city well, and he guides the van through the nicest neighborhoods. He looks at the big houses, with vast green front yards and shiny sports cars parked in the driveways. His parents were never millionaires, but they were well off. He was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. He wishes now he could reverse the decisions that led him to where he is today. If he had finished high school, he could have gotten his electrician's union card. He could be running the business with his older brothers. Or the grocery store, he could be managing it now. But selling drugs was too easy. He passes a particularly opulent house with an expansive front yard and a wraparound front porch. There's a red Ferrari parked in the driveway in front of a detached garage. Three barefoot boys are running through a sprinkler, a teenager, and two younger boys who look like twins. A man wearing glasses, a polo shirt, and a pair of khaki shorts steps out on the front porch. The guy has a smile on his face, like he has it all. I wish I had that guy's life, Danny says to himself, and he drives on. Chapter 8. Stephen Small doesn't even notice the white panel van driving past his house, let alone the scraggly-haired man behind the wheel who is leering covetously at his home. He only pays attention to his boys, who are taking turns running through the sprinkler. His twins, Barrett and Christopher, are laughing as they dart through the water. His older son, Ramsey, tries to do a cartwheel over the spray, but slips and falls into the grass, howling with laughter. Stephen chuckles to himself and heads toward the Ferrari parked in the driveway.
Oh, Stephen,
his wife Nancy calls from behind him. Stephen turns to see his wife holding up a set of keys.
Forget something?
She asks. Stephen laughs and heads back toward the porch. His wife of 18 years has a bright, friendly smile that he fell in love with early in their courtship. Thanks, hon, Stephen says, giving her a hug and a kiss on the cheek.
Where you going, Dad?
Ramsey calls out to him.
I've got to go to the boat shop and pick up a few things,
he says.
Then can we go out on the river?
You bet, Stephen says. He fires up the Ferrari and pulls out of the driveway. The $200,000 car has a V8 engine, but Stephen doesn't push the car too fast, especially in residential areas. He is a careful driver. He takes a slight detour on his way into town and cruises down Kankakee's Riverview Historic District. He slows and creeps past a large, unusual-looking house on a spacious lot. There are a handful of workers going into and out of the building. The 12,000-square-foot house is a historic fixture in the community. Built in 1901, the house was designed by famed architect Frank Lloyd Wright. It has 12 bedrooms and more than 100 windows. Just this month, the house was placed on the National Register of Historic Places. In Stephen Smalls's view, the house is the jewel of the Riverview Historic District. But Stephen isn't just another sightseer slowing down to admire the house. He owns it. A year ago, he bought the house with the intention of renovating it, and perhaps one day turning it into a bed and breakfast. The B. Harley Bradley House, named for the original owner, is Stephen's passion project. He doesn't stop the Ferrari, just slows down, checks to make sure the house is okay, then speeds along toward his destination. He has faith in the workers, but he can't help himself. Stephen keeps an eye on the house whenever he's in the area. If anything happened to the house, he isn't sure what he would do. Chapter 9. Danny pulls his van into a parking space at the local boat shop and strolls in through the door. The air conditioning feels refreshing on his clammy skin.
Hey there, the manager says. What can I do for you?
Danny explains that he needs his deposit back on a boat he put a down payment on.
I don't have the riverfront property I did when I planned to buy the boat, Danny explains.
After his arrest,
Danny moved out of the river house he had used as the base of operations for his drug deals. Not only could he not afford it anymore, but he was also afraid that Mitch would find him there and exact revenge for Danny leading police to his restaurant. He hoped Mitch wouldn't hold a grudge since he'd led the police astray. He'd known Mitch didn't keep any drugs in the restaurant, but he wasn't sure Mitch would see what he'd done as a favor.
"You want your deposit back?" the manager asks. "You know you don't get all your money back, just a portion. It says so in the agreement you signed."
Danny scratches his head and reluctantly says that he understands.
"I need the money," Danny says. "There's no way I can buy a boat anytime soon."
The manager walks into a back office to collect the paperwork and write Danny a check, and Danny stands and waits, looking around. He studies the selection of skis, life jackets, and boat maintenance tools. He feels a wave of depression come over him. There's such a difference between the life he lives now and the life he had a year ago, the life he thought he would continue to have forever. As if he needs another reminder of the difference between what he has and what he wants, Danny watches as a red Ferrari zips into the parking lot and parks next to his van. The two vehicles couldn't look more different. His van is dingy and dented, with rust growing on the doors and a filthy film on the windshield. The Ferrari is gleaming and red, as if its owner washes and waxes it every time he takes it out for a spin. When the driver steps out, Danny can't believe it. It's the same man he'd seen on the drive here. The preppy man with glasses at the house where the kids were playing in the sprinkler. The man walks in the door and starts down the aisle, whistling without a care in the world. Danny stares at him. When the man comes to the counter with a few bottles of cleaning products and a package of sponges, he nods at Danny and says, "Afternoon." The manager comes back to the counter and tells Danny that he'll ring the customer up quickly and then take care of Danny's refund.
"Getting your boat cleaned up?" the manager says politely.
"Yes, sir," the man says enthusiastically. "Gonna take my boys out tubing this afternoon." The man says he has a 30-foot, 500-horsepower speedboat. "The kids love it," he says, taking his receipt and heading out the door. Danny and the manager both watch as the Ferrari glides out of the parking lot.
"I wish I had that kind of money," Danny says.
"You and me both," the clerk says, handing Danny a check.
"Do you know who that is?"
Danny shakes his head.
"Stephen Small."
"I've heard the name." The clerk explains that the Small family just sold its media empire for $64 million. He doesn't know how much Stephen Small got, but it has to be a decent chunk. He says that Stephen Small recently bought the B. Harley Bradley house.
"You know, that fancy house over in the historic district, the one Frank Lloyd Wright designed."
Danny knows the one.
"Some people have it all, don't they?" the clerk says, shaking his head in wonder.
"Not me," Danny groans, and tucks the measly refund into his jeans.
As he walks out the store, the manager calls after him.
"Gotta make your own destiny, man."
Chapter 10. Danny drives around, thinking. He has no destination in mind. He just doesn't want to go home yet. He can't stop thinking about why some people have so much and other people have so little. Why does a guy like Stephen Small get to drive around in a Ferrari and take his family out on a speedboat when Danny has to swing a hammer under the hot summer sun for meager wages? Danny doesn't stop to consider that he was born into a life of privilege and squandered his opportunities. He focuses only on how little he has now and how his father won't even give him a loan.
"It's not fair," Danny thinks.
At a stoplight, he glances in his rearview mirror and notices a black sedan two cars behind him. The windows are tinted, and he can't see the driver. Didn't he see that car earlier today? He can't be sure, but he thinks he spotted the car on his way to his parents' house. He quickly takes a right, and the sedan does too, even though its signal wasn't on while it sat at the light. Could it be Mitch's guys? Or the cops? Danny takes another quick right and looks in his rearview mirror. The car rolls through the intersection without taking the turn. Danny breathes a sigh of relief, still studying the rearview mirror. He looks up in time to slam on his brakes to avoid hitting a car stopped in front of him. Am I just being paranoid? Danny thinks. When traffic begins moving again, Danny speeds out of the neighborhood, checking and rechecking his rearview mirror. He takes a circuitous route to make sure no one is following him anymore. By the time he pulls up in front of the townhouse, Danny has made a decision. Gotta make your own destiny, the manager had said. Danny plans to. He finds Nancy sitting on the couch watching a videotape of Crocodile Dundee. Their air conditioner isn't working, and she looks miserable in short cut-off jeans and a tight t-shirt. Her hair is damp around her forehead, and there are sweat stains on her shirt. There is fresh polish on her toenails and wads of cotton wedged between each toe.
Honey, she says, do you want to go get some ice cream? It's hotter than blue blazes in this house.
I need to run to the lumber yard, Danny says. We can get ice cream along the way if you'd like.
What do you need at the lumber yard?
Nancy asks, pulling the cotton balls out from between her toes. I've got an idea for a new woodworking project.
Is it something you can sell?
Nancy asks, standing up and slipping her manicured feet into a pair of flip-flops.
Not exactly, Danny says. But I think it could make us some money.
Chapter 11. While Danny is looking for the supplies he needs, Nancy wanders to the hardware store. She passes through the paint section, imagining a new color for Benji's room. Then, she looks at some trim and imagines it lining the floor in their living room. She arrives at the appliance section and examines a row of dishwashers, looking at the prices. She wants badly to ask Danny if there's any way to buy a new one. Layaway? A credit card? She hates washing dishes by hand. But she knows what Danny will say. The same thing he says when he suggests she go back to work. No. No, no, no. There's no talking to him. It's always his way or the highway. She wanders through the store, looking at faucets. They could use a new one of those, too. Theirs is always leaking all over the kitchen counter. She exhales deeply, thinking about all the things she can't have. Life had been so easy when Danny was dealing. He'd always had plenty of money for anything she wanted. Dinners in nice restaurants, jewelry and flowers. It was a good life. Much better than working two jobs before Danny came along, but it was a life that always made her feel guilty. She'd made mistakes in the past, and she liked a good party as well as the next gal. But she was trying to be a good mother. What kind of mother lets her drug-dealing boyfriend pay for the roof over her child's head? The answer? Yours truly, Nancy Risch. The guilt had eaten her up, and she'd pushed for Danny to quit dealing. She isn't sure why he finally decided to quit, but he did. She'd initially been skeptical that he would be able to stay clean, but so far, he has. It's been 7 months, and times have been tough for them, but it looks like Danny isn't going to backslide to his old ways. She tells herself she got what she wanted. She needs to be okay with washing dishes by hand, and doing without the unnecessary purchases she used to make. She decides she'll tell him that they don't need to go get ice cream. She doesn't want him to stress about money. She can do without. She finds Danny in the plumbing section talking to an employee about plastic tubing. What the hell is he planning to build? Danny trucks three long pieces of PVC tubing under his arm and grabs a couple elbow joints. The pieces of plastic pipe flop under his arms as he walks to the front of the store. On his way, he grabs a package of caulk and a set of door hinges. At the counter, Danny charges the purchases to his boss's account. Nancy isn't sure if Danny worked this out with his boss ahead of time. It occurs to her that it's possible that his boss purchases so many supplies at the store that he won't even notice an extra charge. She chooses to believe Danny has turned over a new leaf. She needs to stop doubting him. As they're walking out the door, Nancy tells him that she has decided she doesn't want ice cream.
Fine, he says, pulling the van around the back to the store's lumber yard.
She wants him to recognize the sacrifice she's trying to make, but he seems too preoccupied.
It hurts her feelings, and she almost blurts out that she's changed her mind and wants ice cream after all. But just because Danny doesn't appreciate the sacrifice she's trying to make doesn't mean she shouldn't make it. She needs to be supportive, whether he notices or not. Danny shows an employee his receipt. The two men load two sheets of plywood and 6 2x4s into the back of the van.
What the heck are you building?
Nancy asks when he climbs back into the driver's seat. You'll see. Chapter 12. Nancy dumps spaghetti noodles into a pot of boiling water. The water bubbles up and spills over the side, hissing as it hits the open flame of the burner. Next to the pot on the stove is a pan of simmering marinara sauce. She dips a wooden spoon in and gives it a taste. Satisfied, she turns to Danny, who is sitting at the kitchen table next to Benji, and says that dinner will be ready in 10 minutes. Both Benji and Danny are drawing. Using crayons, Benji is drawing a dinosaur fighting a robot. Using a mechanical pencil, Danny seems to be drawing designs for whatever it is he hopes to build. He takes a slug of his beer, his third since they got home, but doesn't take his eyes off the illustration. Danny and Benji look cute together, both locked in concentration. Nancy's heart swells. She has long had her doubts about Danny as a father figure, but now that he is no longer dealing drugs, she feels like he could be a better role model for her son. It's nice to see him engrossed in something. She doesn't know what the heck he's planning to build, he still hasn't told her, but it's a relief just seeing him focused on something besides how difficult life has been lately. Curious about what he's doing, Nancy tries to sneak a peek at the drawing. He sketched out some kind of box, with the 2x4s serving as the frame and the plywood serving as the walls. Danny has no background in technical drawing as far as she knows, but it looks like he's done a decent job of illustrating his design. He's even included measurements for the dimensions of the box. Next to the box, he's drawn what appears to be the PVC pipe. She can't quite figure out what the PVC pipe is for. It looks like it comes out of the box, but there's nothing in the drawing to indicate what it connects to.
Honey?
Nancy says, placing her hand on Danny's shoulder.
Did you hear me? Dinner's almost ready.
Danny jerks his head up as if coming out of a trance. I'm not hungry, he says. I'm gonna skip dinner tonight. I wanna go ahead and get started on this. He grabs his piece of paper and rises. He opens the refrigerator and pulls out 2 more bottles of beer. Before heading to the garage, he stops and gives Nancy a peck on the cheek. At first, she feels a stab of resentment. If she'd known he wasn't going to eat with them, she and Benji could have just eaten leftovers. She wants life to be as normal as possible around here. She wants them to act like a family. If Danny is running off to do something without explanation, that seems more like the Danny of old. But the kiss on the cheek, that quick act of tenderness, erases her bitterness. Despite all the pressure he's under, Danny can still take the time to make her feel special. As she and Benji eat their spaghetti, they can hear a power saw running in the garage, biting through plywood and 2x4s. Then, Danny begins driving nails into the wood. Nancy tries to make Benji laugh by slurping her noodles up. He gives her a half-hearted smile, but he keeps looking distractedly toward the garage. After dinner, Nancy and Benji decide to watch a movie. They turn the movie up loud so they can hear it over the racket. At some point, halfway through, Nancy realizes that the banging and sawing have stopped. After she tucks Benji into bed, she goes out into the garage to investigate. Danny is nowhere to be found. But the box he was building is there. It's about 6 feet long, 3 feet wide, and 2 feet deep, with a hinged lid. The edges are caulked so the box will be watertight except for a 2-inch hole in the lid, where it looks like the PVC pipe will connect. Nancy can't figure out what Danny could possibly mean to use it for. What is he planning to put in it? The damn thing's big enough to hold a person. She presses the button and raises the garage door. Danny's van is missing from the driveway. She steps out onto the concrete and looks up and down the street. The heat is finally broken, and the cool air feels refreshing. But Nancy has a sinking feeling. Again, disappearing in the middle of the night without explanation is behavior typical of the old Danny. She forces the doubt away. You just need to trust him,
she tells herself. Chapter 13. Danny sits in his van down the street from Stephen Small's house. His eyes are bloodshot. He has a cigarette between his lips. The van's window is open, but the smoke pools in the ceiling. Danny takes a drag and jettisons the butt out the window. He glances around to make sure no one is watching him. Then, he lifts a pair of binoculars and spies the Small house. The Smalls aren't particularly careful about closing their shades at night. Danny can see into their house quite well. Through an upstairs window, he sees both parents tucking their twins into bunk beds. Danny can't stand the look of this guy, with his receding hairline and his goofy, aw shucks smile. He's probably never had a hardship in his life. His wife isn't bad-looking, maybe a little homely, but she could do better than him, if he wasn't rich, that is. That has to be the reason she's with him. After they tuck the boys in, they go to their other son's room. Danny can't see well into this one, but he imagines them going through a similar ritual. One big, happy family. It makes Danny sick. He has two children from a previous marriage, and now Nancy wants him to be a surrogate father to her son. He loves children, and Benji is a cute kid, but the responsibility that goes with children is just exhausting. He had liked living in a separate house from Nancy. He was able to go back and forth between the houses whenever he wanted. It was the best of both worlds. He had a girlfriend, but he could live like a bachelor half the time. If he had Stephen Small's kind of money, he'd pay someone to tuck his kids into bed at night so he could go out and party. After the other son's light goes out, Nancy Small heads to what Danny assumes is their bedroom. Stephen trots downstairs and appears briefly in front of the glass window on the front door. He's checking to make sure the door is locked, Danny thinks. Stephen makes the rounds through the house, turning off lights. Then, he heads upstairs. He joins his wife in their bedroom and closes the curtains. Danny can't make out anything but blurs behind the white drapes. Then, the lights go out. The house is dark. Quiet. Danny moves the binoculars over the rest of the property. He studies the detached garage. To leave the house, Stephen Small has to walk from one building to the other. Danny wonders if the side door to the garage is unlocked. He doesn't want to risk checking. There's too much at stake for him to get caught snooping around the property. Danny starts the engine and slowly drives down the street. He doesn't turn on his headlights until he's well past the house he's been spying on. Chapter 14, September 1st, 1987. Nancy sits with Benji at the kitchen table, helping him read a picture book. Their empty dinner plates have been pushed aside, and it's nearing Benji's bedtime. But school hasn't started yet, and she wants to cherish this moment. This is a new book they picked up from the library, one that's more challenging than books Benji read in the past. He needs her help as he reads. Nancy doesn't mind helping him. In fact, she enjoys it. She has already promised that once school starts, she will help him with his homework whenever he asks. She wants to set a good example for the school year. When they get to the last sentence, Benji looks hard and then carefully sounds out the words. "You did it," Nancy says, grabbing him by both shoulders. Benji has a sheepish smile. Nancy tells him to go put his pajamas on and brush his teeth. She'll be in to tuck him in soon. She takes their dinner plates and scrapes the remnants into the garbage. She debates for a moment whether to let them sit in the sink overnight or wash them by hand now. The dishwasher is still broken. She takes a deep breath. No point putting it off until tomorrow. As she's filling the sink with soapy water, she hears a noise and turns to see Danny sauntering in. She hasn't seen him all day. "Hi, hon," she says. "There's still a little bit of dinner. You want me to make you a plate?" He doesn't answer, and Nancy takes a moment to really look at him. His skin is flushed and his eyes are dilated and wild. He doesn't look like he's brushed his hair in days. For that matter, it doesn't look like he's slept in days. At first, she thinks he must be high on cocaine, but she isn't sure. She's seen him stoned plenty of times, but he never looked quite like this. He seems stressed out, to the point he's about to snap. He opens the refrigerator and scans its contents. "Hun,"
Nancy says, this time louder.
I made dinner.
I'm not hungry, he says dismissively. He grabs a half-full gallon of milk and walks over to the sink. He starts pouring the milk into the soapy water.
What are you doing?
Nancy says. She's gonna have to drain the sink now and start over.
I need some water, Danny says, as if that's explanation enough.
He begins to fill the empty jug at the tap. The water in the container is cloudy from the milk residue.
Danny?
Nancy says softly.
Is something wrong?
Don't worry about it, he says, without taking his eyes off the milk jug.
You're not dealing again, are you?
She regrets the words as soon as they come out. Danny's head jerks toward her and he fixes her with bloodshot eyes.
No, I'm not dealing again, goddammit!
He slams the jug down on the counter and milky water sloshes out of it.
If I was dealing again, would we have to live in this crappy little house? He shouts. Would we have a dishwasher that leaks all over the goddamn place?
I'm sorry, I just don't want you doing anything,
she says, trailing off.
Anything what? Danny growls. Anything stupid?
Nancy steps back.
I didn't say that.
No, but it's what you were thinking,
Danny says, leaning over her.
You think I'm stupid?
She cowers against the countertop between the stove and the dishwasher. He raises his hand to slap her, but holds back.
You should be thankful for what I do for you, he says.
Nancy feels a burst of courage, and she stands up straight and glares at Danny with tear-filled eyes.
Don't you love me anymore?
She says. This snaps him from his trance. He lowers his raised hand, looking at it as if he doesn't know how it got there. He takes a few steps back and leans against the counter, his shoulders slumped.
I'm sorry, he says. I'm just really stressed out right now.
Nancy takes a deep breath, steadying her voice.
Let's go to bed, she says. You look exhausted.
I just need a little space right now, he says,
grabbing the milk jug and putting the lid back on.
I've got an errand to run.
He heads to the door, and Nancy stares at the empty space he left behind. She has the feeling of being watched. She turns to see Benji standing at the threshold of the kitchen, wearing striped pajamas. His chin quivers as he tries to stop himself from crying. Nancy kneels and embraces him. His tiny body trembles in her arms.
It's going to be okay, she whispers into his ear. It's going to be okay.
She hopes her son believes her more than she believes herself. Chapter 15. After putting Benji to bed, Nancy walks through the house to make sure the doors are locked. She peeks into the garage and sees that the weird box Danny built is gone. She feels a twinge of relief and isn't sure why. She pours herself a glass of wine and goes to her bedroom. She pulls off her jeans and blouse, and she puts on one of Danny's t-shirts she uses as a nightgown. The shirt is big on her, hanging halfway down her thighs. The shirt smells of him, and the odor gives her mixed feelings. She loves him, but she knows he's not good for her. She stands at the window and looks down onto the street. Part of her wants Danny's van to pull into the driveway. At least that way she would know he's safe. But another part of her doesn't want that. In fact, part of her hopes he never comes home again. She crawls into bed and grabs the telephone from her bedside stand. She dials her friend Julie's number. Nancy takes a long drink of wine while she waits for Julie to answer.
Are you okay?
Julie says right away. Nancy opens her mouth to say yes, but she can't let the lie out.
No,
she says, and she starts to cry.
It's Danny.
What did that bastard do to you? Did he hit you?
No, nothing like that.
Nancy pictures Danny raising his hand to strike her, but she doesn't tell Julie how close he came.
He's just acting really weird. He's up to something.
Is he cheating on you?
Nancy considers this. She wouldn't put it past him. He'd been married with two kids when he started pursuing Nancy. She'd met him at a bar, but she'd avoided him because she knew he was married. He'd been relentless, and she finally gave in. They'd dated, but wouldn't let things get serious until he started divorce proceedings. She remembers how he'd made her feel special, how he claimed that he couldn't stay away from her. His persistence had been flattering. But times have changed. They have no money, and Danny sleeps on the couch more often than he sleeps in bed with her. Maybe that's what this is all about. He's out there chasing women again, and he's found a new pretty young thing to replace.